From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. All summer, protesting Market Basket workers have repeatedly corrected one common description of their actions. They were not on strike. In fact, the supermarket chain's employees insisted they were not interested in unionizing. They just wanted their former CEO back. And late last night, they got him with the announcement that Arthur T. Demoulas and his management team will be reinstated. And while this whole saga has played out in the news, analysts have been trying to unravel what the takeaway is for traditional organized labor as it struggles with massive declines in membership and disappointing outcomes in contract negotiations. Today in The Exchange, what it means for workers to organize in a new century and what new models are emerging. Let's hear from you. Do we still need unions or are they outdated? What other options exist for workers in today's fluid job market? How feasible is it when people change jobs so often for employees to come together as they once did in the past? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for this first segment of our show. Tom Kohan is with us. He's professor of work and employment research at the MIT Sloan School of Management. His most recent book is entitled Restoring the American Dream, A Working Family's Agenda for America. And Tom, very nice to have you. Thanks for giving us your time.
It's delightful to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Kurt Nikisch, WBUR's business and technology reporter, who has been closely covering this market basket situation. Kurt is actually on the scene right now covering what's been happening this morning. Kurt, thank you so much for giving us a couple minutes.
But of course. Thanks. Thank you.
So before, gentlemen, we get into the whole idea of this happened without a labor union and what this means for labor unions in New England, Kurt, could you just give us the latest on this long standoff? As I said, you're right there where it's all happening.
Sure. So it's been sort of simmering for a year, but it really came to a boiling point in July, 6 weeks ago, when Arthur T. Demoulas was ousted as CEO by the board. That is a family-controlled board. This is a family-owned private company. And so it was his boardroom rival and cousin, Arthur S. Demoulas, who deposed him. And since then, workers walked off the job, at least key workers did, that controls the distribution and the warehouses, making sure that food didn't make it to stores. And so it made it easy for customers to boycott with nothing to buy, and the company basically lost millions of dollars per day. And until now they're going to be getting back to stabilizing the company because this deal was struck late last night, and we have some details about it, but essentially all workers can return. And Arthur T. Demoulas returns as not technically CEO yet, but he presumably will be when the deal closes within a few months.
Wow. Well, it's an amazing story. And, you know, it's interesting. The two sides haven't spoken that much. We've heard a lot from the workers, and that's been great. But we haven't heard very much from the mouths of Arthur S. or Arthur T. Did Arthur T. say anything this morning, Kurt?
Yes, he did. He spoke to the workers. He spoke for probably about 10 or 15 minutes. And he told them that he loved them. He said that they are people who are put on earth to have a purpose, and that they showed with their voices and with their togetherness just how strong they are and how important equality within a company is. He said that we are all equals. And this is sort of the family nature, the kind of egalitarian spirit that has driven the company and at least has made workers really loyal to him. And so when he was fired, they backed him, and now they've succeeded. And it's just an amazing, amazing victory for them.
Well, in this hour, we're going to be looking at sort of the future of organized labor and particularly what this market basket situation means for that. You talked to market basket workers throughout this whole saga, Kurt. What did they say to you about why they weren't unionized and why they were not interested in unionizing?
They said that they had a really good running company where management and workers together were on the same page, and they just didn't need a union. They saw no need for it. And I have to say that some of the people who have organized these protests, you know, Steve Palenka, sort of the lead organizer, joked at one rally that he's to the right of patents. So this isn't, you know, general patent. So this isn't necessarily a group of people that, you know, identifies with the left necessarily. It's sort of, you know, blue collar working class, maybe Reagan Democrat type folks who are working here. And whenever union people would show up to say, hey, why don't you unionize or join us? And, you know, we have lots of benefits and can help you through a process like this. They said, you know, we don't need you. We seem to be doing just fine without you. And they did. And that raises a lot of interesting questions about whether this worker action, which was very unique with managers and workers together shutting down the company, is a model for labor movement, you know, in the coming century.
Yeah, and we'll definitely be looking at that this hour with you, Kurt Nikisch, and Tom Kohan, our other guest, professor of work and employment research at the MIT Sloan School of Management. I also want to invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And gentlemen, let's go to our listeners now. Jillian's calling in from Hudson. Hi, Jillian. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Yeah, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to kind of mention that, you know, I think that it's great that Market Basket has won this fight and that they have their choice of boss back. But, you know, I wonder if they had been unionized in the first place, if it wouldn't have been an issue when leadership came, that, you know, you can't really rely on having a benevolent leader in your company. And if they had a union, then they would have been able to fight for better treatment no matter who was in charge.
You know, Jillian, this is a point that others have made. I'd love to ask you, Tom Kohan, on this. You know, some have said, as Jillian does, hey, it's great that you feel so well treated by this one CEO, but why have your working conditions determined by one person? Why not unionize and get the benefits no matter what? What do you think, Tom?
Well, I think Jillian raises a very good point that an existing union would have had a set of contract provisions that would have protected the wages, hours, and working conditions even in a change of management. But what the traditional union model can't provide is this sense of organizational solidarity around the mission of the business. These were managers and workers across the board, as Kurt said, who really were fighting to save the company and save the business model rather than fighting just for their jobs. Certainly they were fighting for their jobs and their working conditions. They were fighting for something that was much broader and much deeper. Now, could we create that in a modern labor management relationship? Yes, absolutely, and I've seen it in other places, like Kaiser Permanente, where the unions are very much engaged in business strategy and the mission of Kaiser as a quality healthcare provider. But they're the exception. So I think this case will open the door for new models of labor management relationship and maybe even union management relations across the country.
Yeah, others did ask Market Basket workers, Kurt Nikisch, why not? The same question that Jillian asked, why lay it all just on one guy? If he goes away or something happens to him or his family, then you're stuck.
Yeah, so this is interesting because they, you know, were very successful in organizing very quickly, using internet technology, right? Using social media and contemporary communication to basically very quickly organize around a collective demand and make it happen. So they showed their power in being able to control even who their boss is. So I feel like, if you talk to them, I think they just feel that, you know, their culture is so strong that determines who. You know, that will end up determining who lead them. And if they get somebody in who they don't like, they can just do the same thing again. So they feel like it's just, the thing is, they feel like they don't need to pay the money to have sort of, you know, a strike fund and to have paid union staff and paying dues to be able to do this themselves. And so, you know, time will tell, and they're still writing business history, but that's what they say, that they are just, they don't need a union. They're able to get what they want.
Yeah, we can hear management professors across New England rewriting their syllabi, right? Seeing what this can teach us. Let's go to another call if we could. John's in Henniker. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I think whoever was speaking just now was close to what I wanted to say, which is that the workers' victory in Market Basket vindicates the idea of collective action. Whether you use a union for that purpose or a union as we have known it is really not the point. Workers can improve their lot if they hang together and focus on what they really need and work in that direction.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Tom, what do you think?
John, I think that's a terrific point, and I think that's the lesson that will resonate with workers across the country, and I suspect it will also be a topic of discussion in corporate boardrooms across the country. That one of the reasons that this resonated so well with the public is that I suspect there are many, many, many workers out there who feel similar frustrations but don't have an outlet for releasing them or for addressing them. And I think that this is giving workers some confidence that if they think creatively, and as these workers did, use the new modern social technology, they can get their point across. We're in a transparent world today, and people can communicate with each other. They understand how businesses work and what makes them successful, and they're going to find new ways to express their points of view, maybe not as dramatically as we've seen here, but I think this is a new form of collective action that will find different variants occurring in the future.
Well, and coming up in just a moment, we'll look more at that, Tom. New outlets for collective action, whether it's a traditional union, whether it's what we've seen in this Market Basket situation. Kurt Nickisch, I know you need to get back on the job. We really appreciate you taking time out for us this morning, and hope you get a little break after this Market Basket situation folds down.
Thanks much. I think there's a little bit of poetic truth here in that we have a Labor Day weekend coming.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kurt, very much.
Sure thing.
That's Kurt Nickisch, WBUR's business and technology reporter. He's been covering the Market Basket situation from the beginning. We will talk more after a short break. This idea of new outlets for collective action. A free enterprise economist will join us as well for that. And we'll hear from you. So keep it all right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Market Basket and what it might mean for the future of worker organizing, for the future of traditional labor unions. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. What do you think these summer-long protests mean for organized labor? What does it mean for workers to organize in a new century? What new models might be out there? 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guest for the hour is Tom Kohan. He's professor of work and employment research at the MIT Sloan School of Management. And joining us now is Aloysius Hogan, senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a libertarian think tank. He specializes in labor and employment policy for the Center for Economic Freedom. And Aloysius, really nice to have you. Thanks for your time.
Laura, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, how do you feel about this whole Market Basket situation? I know you're not in New England, but I'm sure you've heard about it. And what it says about whether we need unions still in today's workforce, in today's workplace.
Boy, I'm glad it's over. I hate to see family squabbles. And my wife's family is from the Boston area, and I have appreciated this situation. I'm glad that's over. But looking forward, it does point up a few lessons. And the first one would be that a good CEO who's connected with the employees deserves the devotion of the workers, but the workers who prove that devoted and productive deserve their good pay and above average pay. And when you have that situation, you don't need a union. And that's lesson number one that the law firms who are engaged in this, as I was employed at a law firm, they will tell you that good employee relations are the number one thing to avoid any luring of people towards a union.
So what if you don't have as benevolent a boss as RDT?
Well, it's proven that social media, as was just mentioned, the Save Market Basket Facebook page is a classic example. It turns out that actually unions are not just not needed. They prove to be actually harmful. We recently did a study about how much unions are costing the worker in lost wages. And in fact, in Massachusetts, it's over $3,300 per worker, and that's over $13,000 for a family of four.
No, I definitely want to get Tom in on this, but can you just connect the dots for us on that, Aloysius, that unions are actually costing workers thousands of dollars? Connect the dots for us there. I'm not quite sure I'm following you.
Well, there is the Wagner Act is the other name for the National Labor Relations Act. It costs workers because there is a mandate of monopoly bargaining. Collective bargaining by the union, which in this day and age, again, this is a good point from the market basket situation, people are used to commenting and expressing their views in any number of ways in our electronic age and rapidly, and when the union speaks for you, you have lost your voice. The right to work laws that, for example, Representative Gary Daniels in New Hampshire is working on, they benefit the workers by end up with jobs growing, the economy flourishing, and people's wages growing is what results. And in fact, people are voting with their feet and moving to jurisdictions that have a right-to-work law.
What do you think about this, Tom? The idea that, you know, people don't need this outside big group speaking for them and, by the way, taking money in the form of dues, that they don't need that anymore.
Well, I think that's an outmoded point of view. This story has been sold for many, many years by the Right to Work Foundations, so-called Right to Work, but it really is an anti-worker, anti-union message. The notion that unions cost workers wages is just not consistent with the evidence. The average union dues is between 1% and 2% a year. The average effective unions controlling for everything that economists control for in this this kind of analysis shows that on average unions increase wages by 10% to 15% and fringe benefits even more than that. So there's no basis for that kind of statement at all in the evidence. The second point that is important is it's, yes, I agree with Aloysius that the collective action here is what really generated the positive outcome, but it took a desperate action on the part of employees to make sure that their voice was being heard. As individuals, they had no way of getting the board of directors to change its position and to get the sale of this business and get this business model back in place. So it's not that one gives up individual voice. It's that people have to agree that they are going to work together to promote something they deeply believe in. That's the collective process. It doesn't mean that it's a substitute for individual voice. Collective voice is only powerful when individuals really are behind it. That's the real lesson here. And we ought to get beyond this silly notion that unions are out of date or no longer necessary and invent the next generation of worker organization that can support good companies and good leaders and good managers and then deal with those who don't value workers as assets in the business.
Well, and I have another question for both of you on that, but I definitely want to bring our listeners into this conversation too. So let's go back to them again. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. John's in Goffstown. Hi, John. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to comment originally on what I thought happened really with the market basket situation, which was like many of the older strikes and older collective action, it was focused on a local institution that had local roots and the bosses were local. Pete Seeger said in one of his songs, the 1,000 people are outside and they all agree that the boss is a bastard. Well, the boss only cares if he's a bastard if he has to deal with those people as his neighbor. And in this case, Market Basket did. And the culture of collective action, the culture of belief in each other, was already established in this company. And so it was relatively easy for these people to to act collectively because they'd been acting collectively right along. As far as the future of unions, what this says is unions need to be organized in ways that respond to the needs of the people who are working. There's no truth in the fact that an individual can stand up against the company, I don't think.
You know, yeah, John, this is a great point and one I wanted to ask you guys. So thank you very much. What about this idea, guys? Aloysius, I'll throw this to you first. You know, part of the thing with Market Basket is it was a local institution with local roots. People were based here. Would a Market Basket type action work at a Walmart, for example, which is a global company?
Walmart has been organized against repeatedly. And Walmart turns out to have resisted that. And in the Walmart situation, which it gets itself involved in groceries, you actually have unionized companies acting against Walmart and hurting the income of the cities that are losing out on the taxes that would come from having a Walmart. And the local chain angle to it is pushed by the unions behind the scene, and actually there's a Boston company that works to oppose Walmart and have strikes against them, but it's really a union versus non-union fight in the Walmart situation.
I guess what I'm asking, Aloysius, is if Walmart employees here in Concord, New Hampshire, for example, decided that their boss was terrible, decided that they were really just, you know, downtrodden and conditions were awful, what would they have the same sort of options that the Market Basket folks had, given again that it's a giant global company instead of a smaller New England company?
That's an excellent point. Of the next generation that Tom mentioned, unions are not working, and so they are going to a next generation model. For example, our Walmart is a non-union group that tries to make that point about Walmart and organizes in its own way, a non-union way, that makes the point. So yes, there is that outlet that has the freedom of association without all the federal mandates that come with a union.
Yeah, what do you think, Tom? Can you apply what happened at Market Basket to a company, you know, like Walmart or Home Depot or any of these much bigger global corporations?
The fundamental difference here is that these were employees who acted on their own, independent of the company. They didn't wait for the board of directors to say it's okay for them to protest or even wait for RDT to say so. They acted on their own independently, and they were fighting to support a business model that they really believed in. The Walmart situation is fundamentally different. Our Walmart is a company-led group of employees, and they can only do what the company will allow them to do. They could never go out there and protest. Where they have gone out and protested, employees have been fired, and we now have litigation around that. So in the Walmart case, you have a business model which is antagonistic to employees. It keeps wages low as part of its business strategy to have low prices. It keeps turnover high. It fights any form of independent voice for workers, whether it's a union or these protests that have been happening spontaneously and across the country. So there you do need a different kind of model. It's a global corporation organizing in Concord or wherever a local Walmart store might be would be inadequate. In fact, would be high risk for those who took those actions. There we need a strong national effort on the part of consumers, on the part of employees, and really some new labor legislation to make it happen.
Well, this gets into the labor legislation, and a lot of people say that our current labor laws are massively outdated, you know, written a long, long time ago for a different era. Just describe that for us, if you could, Tom, and Aloysius, I want to hear from you, too, but go ahead, Tom.
As Aloysius said, the law was passed in 1935, and it was a time when there was a clear division between workers who did the work, and managers and supervisors who represented the company. It built in a collective bargaining process that was badly needed for those days, And it continues to be needed in many, many circumstances. But frankly, right now, any employer that wants to beat a union and avoid unionization can do so through legal and illegal methods, because the penalties are so weak and the enforcement is so slow that employers can violate the law without much consequence. We need a fundamental updating of our labor law. We need a labor law that allows the full spectrum of the workforce to have a voice, not necessarily an antagonistic voice, but as we heard from our Market Basket employees, maybe some form of enterprise or works council, as we see in Europe, where it's a cooperative engagement around sharing information about the business and how can we promote continuous improvements. And then if employees really want to join a union for collective bargaining, there has to really be strong rights enforced so that the employees make that choice, so it's not labor lawyers and consultants who thwart unionization or managers who make that choice, but it's employees. And then we have to open up the process to collaborative forms of bargaining. We do a lot of training around how to engage in more problem-solving negotiations. We've got to eliminate the constraints over what issues you can discuss so that employees can discuss the business model and employees can discuss how they can contribute effectively, and just get away from some of these ossified doctrines that reflected the industrial economy of the 1930s.
Well, and picking up on something you said there about this sort of ossified idea of who's labor, who's management, we've got an email here from Tana in Portsmouth who says, I think the biggest difference between the Market Basket protests and a typical union strike is that Market Basket management, from corporate headquarters to individual stores, led the protest. Tana says that is very different from a typical strike where often the lowest workers on the food chain strike. I'd love your thoughts there too, Aloysius.
Well, you talk about new models, and yes, there needs to be new labor law. The labor law needs to be pulled back away from the old model, and what we've seen the old model produce is the likes of Detroit. And Detroit, which used to be a thriving city, has come crashing down. We've seen income growth of 10% higher in states that have right-to-work laws where you're not forced to join a union in order to get a job. You shouldn't have to be forced. You shouldn't have to pay the dues. You shouldn't have to pay that sort of stuff. People don't want to spend like $400 or $500 that they could spend on Christmas presents or birthday presents or a vacation in August or Labor Day. Job growth is 55% higher in states that have these right-to-work laws.
Although unemployment rates are often higher, aren't they?
No,
it's been a while since I looked at the right-to-work issue, but my recollection is that unemployment rates tended to be higher in those states that had right-to-work.
No, the job growth is 55% higher in states with right-to-work. And the people are voting with their feet. People are moving to places that have these laws, these right-to-work laws, as New Hampshire has been considering. And you've had 5 million people over the last decade move out of forced unionism states to right-to-work states.
Yeah, and again, I wanted to not make this a whole show about right to work, but I would like your thoughts on that, Tom Cohan. He's right. Aloysius is right. This has been a big debate in New Hampshire, and there's some dispute about the status of workers in right to work states, the unemployment rates, the wages, and whether companies are or are not moving. Your quick thoughts there, Tom, and then we'll go back to our listeners.
The clear evidence is that the jobs that are growing in the right to work states are very, very low wage jobs. Wages are lower in places like Texas that talk about all the job growth than in other parts of the country, and that's the standard model. The job growth is the movement of people. The evidence shows that what people are moving for is lower housing costs. People are moving out of expensive New York cities and Bostons because young families can't afford to start here because of the housing costs. It has nothing to do with unionization. The best evidence on that is that it's all really housing situation that's driving it. We've got to get away from all of this division. People in this country are looking for us to pull together. The notion that people are forced to join a union, that's bogus. People make their own choice about joining a union. Yes, if they negotiate a union shop clause, then they have to pay their fair share of the dues. But no one is forced into taking a job with a union. No one is forced to support the union in ways that they don't want to do if their views are different. But I do believe that this division that the Right to Work Foundation has fostered is unhealthy for the country. It's not what workers want. It's not what good businesses want. They want a cohesive workforce working together. If that means working collectively in some fashion, then the best leaders and the best managers of this country are ready to do that.
All right.
Let's get on with it.
I think we're going to have to take another look at this issue, and we probably will when the legislature reconvenes, because the Right to Work bill will probably come up again. Aloysius, thank you very much for giving us your time this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, and good luck with the Right to Work votes to come in New Hampshire.
Okay, that's Aloysius Hogan, senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He specializes in labor and employment policy for the Center for Economic Freedom. We'll take more of your comments and questions in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the market basket situation, which resolved itself, it seems, last night with the return of CEO RDT Demoulas. We've been looking at this situation and also what it means for organized labor. More than one analyst has noted that market basket workers got what they wanted without the help of a union. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guest for the hour is Tom Kohan. He's a professor of work and employment research at the MIT Sloan School of Management. His most recent book is entitled Restoring the American Dream, A Working Family's Agenda for America. In just a moment, we'll also talk with Mark McKenzie, president of the New Hampshire chapter of the AFL-CIO. But Tom, I did want to go back to our listeners and invite Jamie in Concord to join us. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi, Laura. Thank you so much. I think one of the very good example in this state of where unions have made a tremendous impact is within the university system. The University of New Hampshire in Durham and Keene State both have unionized faculty, full-time faculties, whereas Plymouth does not. Their adjuncts unionized, but their faculty did not. Curiously, they had a person from Towers Watson, a retiree, join their board. They benchmarked the benefits for Plymouth against for-profit and non-for-profit companies in their pool. They ended up lowering the health benefits, but they didn't do a benchmark of the actual faculty salaries. So they lowered the benefits. They didn't raise the salaries by using the same benefit pool. And if you look at the salaries in Plymouth versus those of the faculty in Durham and Keene, you'll see a tremendous difference. And one of the tactics used was to reach out to individual faculty behind the scenes and offer them better, huge packages relative to other faculty. So there's little transparency in who makes what. And so that's one of the tactics used, and consulting firms are brought in just to undermine the collective bargaining method.
So wages and benefits are better at the unionized universities than the non-unionized, Jamie. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that benefits and salary are better, and that it was rather unfair to benchmark the benefits against for-profit, a pool of for-profit and non-profit companies, without doing the same thing for the salaries.
If I could ask you a quick question, Jamie, because this has come up a lot when we talked about higher education a couple months ago here at NHPR. One of the criticisms of unionized professors is that the costs go up so much for the university that they resort to hiring fewer full-time people and they rely more on adjuncts. So a small group of people, you know, wins in the form of higher salaries and better benefits. But a larger group of people loses because they're sort of cut out of that. What do you think, Jamie?
I think that when you look at what is driving the cost of higher education, I would wonder if it's more dormitories, et cetera, because when you look at what someone with a master's or a PhD in corporate America makes relative to what someone with a master's or a PhD in the non-profit academic sector makes, there's a huge disparity. and the disparity obviously on the academic side. And these are people that have often deferred income for at least 10 or more years in getting their PhD. And so I think that that's an invalid argument. And I would look for costs in terms of dormitories and structural buildings and amenities and things like that that people are now trying to attract students. With the proliferation of private colleges and universities, and we really do need to strengthen and keep strong our public colleges and universities and do keep them affordable.
Okay.
So looking at capital outlays rather than in football stadia, et cetera.
Sure. And Jamie, we talked about this in a whole, we did a whole series on the cost of higher education. So I'll leave that aside for now, but I really appreciate your thoughts there. And it is interesting to see some of the unionization on college campuses. Tom Cohan, I'd love your thoughts there too.
Well, I think Jamie is the great example of the next generation collective action. Here's someone who has looked at the data, who has shared information with her colleagues, who has put together a reasoned argument based on the evidence of what is the positives and the negatives of unionization and the fairness or unfairness of the boards that are overseeing the university. And so Towers Perrin, as a consulting firm, better figure out that they no longer have a monopoly on this information, and whatever reports they write better very well reflect the reality of the workplace, because workers are going to take notice, and she's exercising collective voice by speaking out the way she did. And I think that's the kind of workplace we're going to see in the future. It'll take traditional forms of organizing. She articulated very clearly the differences between union and non-union settings in academia as well as in other parts of the private sector. And I think we'll see more and more people like Jamie speaking out in that way.
Let's bring another voice into our conversation. Mark McKenzie is with us on the line, president of the New Hampshire chapter of the AFL-CIO. That's the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations. Mark McKenzie, welcome back to The Exchange. Good to have you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Laura.
Well, first of all, everybody's been talking about this market basket situation all summer, finally resolved late last night. And I'm sure you've heard people say, Mark, hey, this shows that maybe workers don't need unions anymore. What do you think?
Well, I mean, first of all, when you think about what they did, there's certainly some unique pieces of what Market Basket did. The idea that you had a CEO who, was very popular. You had a culture and a history within that organization of support of this fight that has gone on a long period of time. Everybody knew it. And everybody identified who the, who the enemy was, I guess, unquote. So I think they knew and they were focused. But the real thing about this is the concept of this collective action that people, and I think that's the amazing thing about this, that not only were workers, part-time, full-time workers engaged in this, but you also saw the consumers exercise their, collective action in and of themselves by supporting, the workers. And so I think it's a terrific development. Does it replace unions? I don't think it does by any means. But it is another, it's another opportunity for people to come together. And I think it's something that all of us are going to be looking at.
Well, and some have said, Mark, and again, I'm sure you've heard people say this, that the thing that was unique and special about this is that managers were involved. Traditional union disputes are sort of labor on one side, management on the other. In this instance, everybody was united. What does that say about the need to perhaps rethink the way that traditional labor unions go about negotiations or think about who's who, who's a manager, who's an employee? Sometimes those lines are very blurry.
Well, I mean, you're right. But, first of all, let me say that, President Trumka from the AFL-CIO at the recent convention in Los Angeles at our convention recognized and put, very clear message out there that, the world is changing, things are changing, and that the organization that represents workers needs to change as well. So I think this is exactly the kind of thing that you're going to see more of in this country. There are places where this kind of groundswell develops in among workers And they may not be union necessarily, but they become, they act and they use their collective power. So this is exactly, I think, where the labor movement was going. And I think we're trying to find our place in that whole process as this new kind of thing develops within the labor movement, within the workers.
Well, and looking at the numbers yesterday, getting ready for the show, Mark, union participation in the private sector, again, we're not talking about the public sector yet, has gone down from something like 35% in the 1950s to under 7% today. Why have these numbers dropped so precipitously?
Well, I think you take a look at, just look around the environment you're sitting in. You know, where are your shoes made? Where are your clothes made? Where are the products in your office made? Where are your computers made? Where are your screens made? You know, all of this stuff was all based in the United States for a long period of time. And I think what's happened is we've hollowed out the core of manufacturing in this nation. We've raced to other nations to try to find the cheapest, least expensive way to do things. And I think that that's actually catching up. I think the economy is, in the years to come, will level out. It's not going to be today or tomorrow, but certainly there's going to be some leveling in that. I think that you're seeing more manufacturing come back to this country. It's more profitable to do it now in this country than ship it from one part of the world to the other. So, I think you're going to see, a resurgence of it. But let's understand that the labor movement, where we had density, was really in those places where you used to employ a lot of people making things. And now you don't have that kind of density because we don't make stuff like we used to.
Sure. So in New Hampshire, and you're well aware of this, Mark, most people, or many people, I should say, work in services, work in healthcare, work in tourism, work in retail. Those are some of our big, big sectors. So how do you even begin to unionize those folks when they're working part-time, or maybe they're only working there for a year, or, they're just not interested because it doesn't seem to fit that traditional model? What's your role there for those folks?
Well, I think, first of all, that, people come to work in different times in their life. But the reality is that most people are working because they have to, not because they necessarily wake up every day and just, that they want to. Some people are working two and three jobs today just to make a living. And I think our role there is to make sure that people understand that they can use their voice and use, their collective action to change their lives. And that's what we tell people all the time when they call our office, and quite frankly, they're calling more than they ever have.
Really?
About how to get, how to use this, how to come together. And the biggest problem that we face is kind of the fear factor with workers because they have been so beat down over the years when they try to organize unions by companies who bring in hired guns and knock them around. But in the end, I think that what Market Basket does is to say that, look, at people are willing to stand on the street in the heat, in the cold, in the rain. The customers are willing to do the same thing, and that they can make a difference in their lives. Again, this is a very different situation, but all over the world, we're going to see these kinds of actions happening. So I think it's the low point in the labor movement right now, but I think we have great opportunities to grow.
Tom Kohan, what do you think? Mark makes a good point about the decline in manufacturing, the global economy, how that's hurt unions, and you haven't seen these other sectors unionize as they did in the past. I'd love your thoughts there, Tom.
Well, Mark is right about some of the reasons for the decline, but I think we have to take the workforce and the economy as we find it today, and it is a service-driven workforce. That means the organizing models have to adjust, as he indicated, and go with where the workers are. Instead of the exclusive representation when you get 50% of current workers to vote for a union, I think unions will have to organize individual workers, support them in whatever ways they need it in their job, stay with them with a lifetime commitment to say, as you move across jobs, we will continue to provide support. They have the same rights to collective voice and to protest, whether they are under a collective agreement or not, as we saw here in Market Basket. And I think this will embolden unions to take a few more risks in how they organize, how they represent, how they serve workers for whatever kinds of job situations they're in. But it's going to take a very different organizing model. And it's going to take a positive organizing model to say, we can help you achieve whatever goals you see as important. And you don't have to hate the boss in order to be a member of our organizations. We are here to support you, to provide the services that you need, and, by the way, to stand up and protect you if you are treated unfairly. That's the future of the labor movement.
What do you think about that, Mark McKenzie? We're here to support you in your goals, not necessarily what we think you need, but what you need. And it doesn't have to be adversarial.
Well, I unfortunately, you know, my experience in the labor movement over the number of years, nearly 40 years I've been in it, is that, you know, there are, the nature of the American labor movement is an adversarial kind of environment. But I think there are great opportunities, again, as President Trump has said, to really, you know, meet people where they are and to teach them, you know, some of the skills that we know and figure out new ways to bring people to this, to a place where they get better wages and working conditions and other things like that, which is a goal of the labor movement. We may do it, as you said, in different ways, but I think we're committed to readjusting the way we look at the world, look at work, and really try to meet people where they are.
Okay. Well, Mark McKenzie, good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, though.
Tom Kohan, last question for you, if I could. You know, we've touched on this idea of new models, and you've given us a sense of how some of those work. But give us your favorite example of a worker organization that is not a traditional union, but is still making things happen for workers.
Oh, I think one of the classic examples is something called Restaurant Opportunity Centers. It came out of the 9/11 tragedy in New York to help the restaurant workers who many of them lost their lives and families and jobs in the wake of that tragedy. But here you have an organization that is not a traditional union that organizes workers in restaurants both for improving their wages and working conditions and to promote sustainable food practices and healthy foods. And they build coalitions with customers so that they ask when customers go into a restaurant not only to rate the food and the quality of the meal, but also the service, and ask about the job conditions that people are working under to deliver the high-quality food. And they're building coalitions around the country, working with good restaurant owners who want to provide the best they can for employees and in low-wage jobs, respecting their rights, providing good service, and marketing on the basis of we have good food, good service, good employees. That's the kind of example. And there's a book called Beyond the Kitchen Door that I would recommend to your readers. You can. I'm not making. This isn't my book.
You're not making a pitch
the
here.
The founder of Restaurant Opportunity Center.
But it's an interesting example. If I could just ask you real quick, because we're nearing the end. So it's the idea, and we saw this with Market Basket. Customers also refused to shop there, although after a while there wasn't much to shop for. But you're saying this almost puts the customer in a position of, okay, if I have a choice between restaurant A and restaurant B, and I know B treats its workers better, then, yeah, I'm going to eat there.
Absolutely. And we need to keep using all the social media available to get that message out, to build a broad coalition, to really get this country moving in a direction where we all benefit from better jobs, better businesses, and better consumption opportunities.
All right. Well, Tom, thank you so much for being with us the hour. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura. Happy Labor Day.
That's Tom Kohan, again, professor of work and employment research at the MIT Sloan School of Management. His most recent book is called Restoring the American Dream. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our intern is James Pouliot. Lots more resources and stories and information about Market Basket on our website, nhpr.org. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.